you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Because it's summer, I'm going to be taking a break from putting up new guest interview shows for the next 6 weeks or so. But never fear, the show must go on, and so I'll be posting compilations of the best of my older Patreon commentaries from late 2017, which most of you haven't heard before, but which still retain their timeliness. I'll be combining two or three of these each week with related themes or topics into a full program, and I'm sure you'll find them interesting. They'll also give you a sense of the kinds of bonus content I post at Patreon, which you can gain access to in a more timely fashion by signing up as a patron there, rather than having to wait 6 months or so to hear them as part of a compilation like the one I'll be posting today. Today's show features two commentaries from late last fall and early winter, which address the white nationalist and neo-Nazi movement in America. The first explores the practical and philosophical absurdity of white nationalism, and the second examines and deconstructs the anti-Jewish bigotry of the movement, demonstrating the ridiculousness of neo-Nazi claims regarding Jewish power, wrongdoing, and influence. So take a listen and enjoy this, the first of several Best of Tim Wise commentaries. And check out the show archives on Patreon, Podomatic, or through a podcast directory like iTunes. Well, there's part of me that wishes I did not have to do this particular commentary, but I think that circumstances have left me with very little choice. Today, I want to talk a little bit about the issue of white nationalism, which is being articulated far and wide in the wake of the election of Donald Trump by the so-called alt-right or white supremacist, white nationalist folks online. Of course, the people who gathered in Charlottesville back in August and continue to hold various rallies around the country, most recently one in Shelbyville, Tennessee, and then an aborted one in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. In the wake of this upsurge of white nationalist activity, it has become necessary to actually explain why the fundamental logic of white nationalism is itself flawed. And I hate to have to do this, but you know, I think we've come to that point. For years, the mantra on the sort of anti-racist left was that you don't respond to these people, that you don't respond to their arguments, you don't give their ideas any more validity than they deserve, you don't give them a platform. And, you know, that used to work in the pre-internet days where they had to publish their own newsletters and their reach was limited. But in a wired world, folks can get their message across without your help, without your platform. So if you don't respond to them, All that is a failure to respond, and they continue to spread their poison. And as the old saying goes, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still pulling on its boots. So it's pretty obvious, I think, that these ideas that go under the rubric of white nationalism or white supremacy have grown in power and persuasiveness. And it's not because we took the time to reply to them and discredit those ideas, but quite possibly because we didn't. You know, it isn't enough to simply call people Nazis or racist and assume that that will be sufficient. There might have been a time when it was, but now, sadly enough, it is not. One of the reasons is that racism, if not Nazism, racism at least, white supremacist thinking, has long been embedded in American politics. It's not an aberration. It's actually quite normal. Throughout the history of American politics, it has worked before. In fact, it's probably the oldest play in the playbook of American politics, is to use white racial resentment to stoke political backlash against people of color or whoever is the deemed out group at a given time. So to believe that somehow simply painting people as racist is going to turn the public against them, particularly the white public, is to ignore all of American history. And as demographic change has continued to take place, as the culture has continued to shift to a much more multicultural place than it was, as the economy has continued to fracture so that economic anxiety, even for white folks, is a much bigger thing now than it would have been 25 and 30 years ago. And after the election of the first black president, those politics of white anxiety and resentment really were given and have been given new life. And they're trying to offer those politics as simply the sort of white equivalent of identity-based politics that are engaged in by people of color. In other words, what they're saying is, if it's okay for black people to organize for their interest, if it's okay for Latino people to organize for their interest, if it's okay for Asians or whatever to organize for their interest, why isn't it okay for white people? It's a very intoxicating logic. It's something we've heard for years in various forms. You know, people saying, well, if there's an NAACP, why can't there be an NAAWP? And David Duke actually did found the NAAWP after he left the Klan in 1980 and 81. He founded that organization. He was the head of it, actually, until 1990, and then still deeply involved in it for several years afterward. And that was the argument. Well, if you can have an NAACP, why not an NAAWP? If you can have Black History Month, why not White History Month? If you can have BET, why not WET? You know, all this stuff. We've all heard these arguments made, usually by seventh graders, usually by people who are about 12, at least intellectually speaking, but occasionally by adults as well, who find that stuff persuasive. It's the people who say, well, if you can say Black Lives Matter, why don't you say White Lives Matter? If you, you know, all this stuff. If you can have minority scholarships, why not white scholarships? Right? It's essentially saying that if identity politics are okay for this group, it's okay for that group. But I want to respond to that a minute. I want to give some time to this. I mean, this is absurd to even have to do this. It ought to be obvious. But the fact of the matter is, these things are not seen as being different, in spite of the fact that they are. People who say that stuff, people who say, well, if we have a Black History Month, why don't we have a White History Month? Or if we have an NAACP, why don't we have an NAAWP, are speaking as if history didn't happen. They are speaking as if there was no historical context to racial inequity in this country whatsoever. Just white people and black people and others sort of bumping into each other. No history of oppression by some against others. No history of marginalization of some to the benefit of others, right? It's just white people here, black people here, and we can all just organize for our interest as if history did not happen. Talking about White History Month as if every other month was not already that. Talking about the need for an NAAWP as if the United States Congress had not functioned like that for the vast majority of its history, as if the Fraternal Order of Police does not continue to do so today, as if the Fortune 500, at least for rich white people, doesn't do so. I mean, there are numbers of organizations that work to the benefit disproportionately of white people. They don't get called that, but that's the whole point, right? When you're the dominant group, you don't have to specify the institutions that work to your benefit because the system as a whole generally works to your benefit. Now, I realize there are white folks who are left out of that equation. I realize that poor and working class white folks get the shaft under capitalism. I understand that. But the reality is that white interests, generally speaking, have been vouchsafed by the larger institutional workings of the society. So you don't have to set up special organizations or special months of the year to teach about those folks. You don't have to set up specific scholarships for white people because the vast majority of scholarships are already going to white people. In fact, the data tells us that only about 0.25% of all scholarship dollars in the country are specifically set aside for quote-unquote minority scholarships, and only about 3% of African-American students, for instance, are receiving any kind of scholarship like that, right? So the vast majority of people of color don't get those scholarships, and virtually none of the scholarships that are given in this country are those kinds of scholarships, but we still believe that because, again, the politics of white resentment have led us to think that way. The point being, of course, that when white folks are hurting, and many are, it's not because of their whiteness, it's in spite of it, right? Whiteness may not always protect you. It may not always guarantee you a great life, but it certainly is not the basis of your injury. It's not the basis of your hardship. If anything, you can think of it as sort of a systemic or institutional safety net that was intended for your benefit as a white person, which may well have ended up failing you. Sometimes safety nets do fail. They have holes in them, right? But the answer to that is not to rebuild that particular safety net, which was predicated on unearned advantage, unfair advantage over others. Rather, the answer is to bond around different identities, like shared class interests that are being sacrificed for all working people, let's say, in a class system, for instance. But this larger idea about white identity politics being no less legitimate than people of color identity politics, there's a real significant problem with that argument, even at the most basic philosophical level, right? Because this is not simply the white equivalent of the NAACP or the Black Student Union or various support groups for people of color. There's a difference contemporaneously and there's a difference historically. Contemporaneously, if you listen to what the Richard Spencers of the world say and the Matt Heimbachs of the world say, they're very clear what their actual end game is. It is not simply to, quote unquote, defend the interest of white people, whatever we might take that to mean, as in some pluralistic arrangement where white people are simply trying to make sure that our rights are protected and, you know, and we're safe and we're not being discriminated against and we're all going to live happily ever after in a pluralistic society. That's not what they're fighting for. What they're fighting for, I mean, Richard Spencer says that he believes in the creation of a white ethnostate, and in his words, it may be bloody and violent and terrible, his words, that people may have to be purged from the United States. He tries to say it'll be, you know, peaceful ethnic cleansing, but the very fact that he even refers to it as ethnic cleansing tells you this is not the same as what the NAACP does or what Black and brown civil rights organizations do. Matt Heimbach, in a recent interview on a podcast, said that the only proper stance toward Jews was exterminationism. His words, I mean, this is the head of the Traditionalist Workers Party, one of the leaders of the modern white nationalist movement, calling for the extermination of Jews. I mean, this is their worldview. There is no equivalent of that in the NAACP. There is no equivalent of that in the Urban League, whatever organization you want to name. There just isn't one. The Congressional Black Caucus doesn't call for that kind of shit. So it's just not the same. Historically, it's not the same either, because historically, there's always been a very specific meaning attached to whiteness. So when you say you're going to organize on the basis of whiteness to protect white interests, please understand what that means. The whole concept of whiteness was created for only one reason. There was no such thing as the white race historically. White people didn't consider ourselves members of one big happy family. We spent most of our history in Europe killing one another. There was no pan-European unity. Whiteness was created as a concept fundamentally in the colonies of what would become the United States for the purpose of dominating people who didn't qualify for that designation. In other words, whiteness was always bound up with the notion of white domination, hegemonic dominance, supremacy, colonialism, genocide, conquest. So to talk about protecting interest as white people and rallying to defend our interest as white people is almost by definition, given that history, to talk about rallying for the purpose of maintaining white supremacy, because whiteness has never meant anything but domination. So to bond on that basis is to essentially reify and legitimize the historical meaning of whiteness, which isn't real in cultural terms. It isn't real in racial terms. It isn't real in ethnic terms. There are significant, quote-unquote, racial differences, culturally, linguistically, between people of various European descent. Whiteness was simply this glue that was used to bond all European peoples together as a way to dominate non-European peoples. So to bond on that basis is inherently different. Now, one might argue, well, blackness too is artificial. There was no Pan-African unity prior to conquest, colonialism, enslavement. And to some extent, that's true. Certainly the continent of Africa was not bound by common culture, common linguistics. There were certain cultural traits that were very similar. But yeah, there wasn't a thing called black people. That's true. But the difference is that blackness was something that was created in response to oppression. Blackness was the terminology and the concept laid upon African descended peoples by white supremacy, and it was that basis that black folks used to resist. It was that identity as oppressed and marginalized people of African descent, now called black, let's say, that was the basis of their resistance. To bond for your interest as an act of resistance to oppression is by definition different, is it not, than bonding on the basis of your dominance? I mean, if you can't tell the difference between organizing for your collective interest as the marginalized trying to fight marginality versus organizing on the basis of your interest as the dominant group to maintain your domination, I don't know what I can do for you. I mean, those things are rather obviously different, aren't they? Right? It's the difference between organizing for a seat at the table and organizing so as to keep the whole damn table to yourself. I mean, that's the difference. It's black and brown folks organizing for a seat at the table, especially because they built the damn table in many ways. They cooked the friggin' meal. And white folks saying, we're going to organize on the basis of whiteness is about keeping the guest list exclusive. That is fundamentally different, historically and contemporaneously. I mean, for whites as the, you know, dominant racial group to organize to protect our interest would be like able-bodied people lobbying for, you know, special able-bodied parking spaces at the mall, right? Or it'd be like rich people demanding that Habitat for Humanity build them a house, or CEOs forming a union so they can make sure to get a better deal when they negotiate with workers. I mean, it's redundant to do this kind of thing when you already have power. And I know the response, of course, right? These folks would say, well, despite historical dominance, all that is threatened now. All that is under attack. They'll say, well, we're organizing for our interest because now we're the ones being marginalized. And they'll talk about affirmative action. They'll talk about all these things. And of course, we know from the evidence, it's very clear affirmative action has done very little to alter the power dynamics in this country. People of color are still considerably more likely to be out of work. African Americans with a college degree, for instance, almost twice as likely as whites with a degree to be out of work, regardless of major, regardless of their academic discipline. Every single indicator of well-being, right, says that white folks are hardly being marginalized or oppressed by this thing called affirmative action. But that's the argument they make. They'll say, well, what do you expect us to do? Wait around until the script has been flipped? I mean, we have to defend ourselves now. But the reason we know this isn't an honest argument, in addition to the data which says that white people are not being oppressed, is that historically, white folks have been screaming about so-called reverse discrimination and about us being the victims for literally over 100 years. I mean, you can actually go back to the 1880s. 1883, the Supreme Court throws out a bunch of post-emancipation civil rights laws. And Justice Joseph Bradley, writing for the court, said that it was time for the Negro to stop being the special favorite of the laws and take his place among mere citizens. Of course, the irony being that up until emancipation, the only citizens were white. So to believe that somehow the black folks were the ones being favored takes an incredible inversion of reality. But there it was. You had white folks, even 20 years after emancipation, beating the drum of reverse racism. At every step forward in the journey towards civil rights and racial equity, white folks have screamed and yelled like a stuck pig about how we're being victimized. Carol Anderson writes about this in her brilliant book, White Rage. Every step forward is seen as this oppressive thing towards white people. So when these white nationalists say, well, we're organizing for our interests because you just never know when we're going to be the oppressed, we've been saying that for 100 years. But now, one of the arguments that the white nationalist folks make, and again, this is where they try to get creative and they try to sort of downplay the horror of what they're actually advocating, which again is ethnic cleansing, it's racial purging. They make the argument that, you know, white nationalism rests upon one key premise above all else, and it's the premise of free association, right? The idea that white people ought to be able to live amongst themselves, ought to be able to associate only with other white people, ought to be able to live in intentional white communities. One of the things that Jared Taylor, one of the nation's most prominent white nationalists, always argues is that right now, all he's really pushing for, he says, well, we just need to repeal civil rights laws, because if we go back to free association, if we just get rid of these laws that force us together, whether that's desegregated schooling, whether that's civil rights laws that require equal opportunity in the workplace, or whether it's housing discrimination laws, if we just get rid of those things, according to Taylor and some of the less overtly violent, let's say, of the white nationalists, that we'll go back to free association, white people will stick around white people, black folks around black folks, and everything will be fine. In other words, Taylor is sort of suggesting that you wouldn't necessarily need an ethnostate if we just went back to free association. But the problem with this premise is, or ought to be, pretty obvious, right? To begin with, if you're talking about the ability of white people to just go and live amongst themselves, they have the right to do that. Nothing is stopping them from doing that. If they want to go set up a compound, the way that various religious sects have done over the years, no one's stopping them from doing that. If they want to go out and buy a tract of land for their compound, and they want to try to build a utopian all-white society, nobody's going to give a damn. Well, I certainly don't mind. Matt Heimbach asked me that at a talk. He came to one of my speeches. He and his buddies came and protested, and he came in and asked me a question during the Q&A. He said, if you think we're so horrible, why don't you let us go? And I said, go. No, nobody's stopping you, buddy. Get your money together, pack all your shit in a truck, and move to Montana. What in the hell is stopping you, other than maybe Montanans who don't want your ass? But, you know, if you want to go out there and buy some land, but see, that's the thing. They don't want to do that. They don't want to go out there and actually buy land and have to work it. These people don't work. So when you start saying that white people have the right to associate with one another, of course you do. You have the right to have your private clubs. You have the right to have your little white supremacist cell. You have the right to go out and build a friggin' compound if you want. What you do not have the right to do is to tell other people that they are not also free to move where they want. See, that's the problem, right? When you start talking about free association, if it's true for you, it's true for everyone. And that means that if black folks want to move into that space because they like the fresh air, or they like the fact that the trash gets picked up twice a week, or they just want to get out of the city or whatever, you can't tell them that they can't. See, this is why you know they don't believe in free association, because they only believe in it for themselves. For white people like Jared Taylor, Richard Spencer, Matt Heimbach, or any of these folks in the white nationalist movement to call for the right to be left alone after having asserted previously the right to conquer the entire continent, to enslave other people by force, to colonize the world, is fundamentally morally inconsistent. These are people, these white folks wouldn't even be here in a position to assert their right of self-determination or free association had it not been for the violation of that same principle vis-a-vis others who probably would also love to have been left alone, right? The indigenous of the Americas would have loved to have been left the hell alone. African people would have loved to have been left the hell alone. So when you then turn around and say that white people should have the right to be left alone and associate only with our kind after we have violated that right vis-a-vis African peoples by stealing them, after we violated that right vis-a-vis indigenous people by stealing their land, is the height of disingenuousness. And what it really does is it reduces this entire conversation to a might makes right calculus, right? It's that we want the right to be left alone, and we were powerful enough to beat you and to conquer you and to enslave you, and so now we have the right to assert this right even though you didn't. This is not a moral argument, it's a might makes right argument. All these guys in the white nationalist movement, at the end of the day, they are admitting with every word that they utter that they are dedicated to total war against anyone that they do not believe to be white. Theirs is not a movement of intellectual and moral principle, it's a movement of conquest, it's a movement of domination, it's a movement of control, which seeks power for power's sake, an entirely fascist precept which is incapable of existing side by side with any pretense to democratic norms or institutions. If we are going to fight it, we have to understand this. This is a movement that, unchecked, cannot lead to anything other than mass violence and the complete destruction of those seen as standing in its way. If might makes right, and it clearly does in the worldview of white nationalists, they cannot be expected, we cannot expect them, to accept a partial victory or to exist and coexist on pluralistic terms and not see it through to the end. Their goals, however much they try and hide them, however much they lie about them, are genocidal. And as a result of that, they must simply be stopped. And hear me now, by any means necessary. Watch out. Well, you really have to hand it to Nazis. I mean, they are nothing if not consistent, and I guess there is something to be said for consistency. Every couple of days, I make the mistake of going and checking my Twitter feed. I didn't do this for a couple of years. I just never looked at it, you know. But every now and then, I'm bored. I got nothing better to do. Blood pressure's feeling a little low, you know. And I decide, oh, what the hell, I'll go check it out. And every time, and I mean every time, the overwhelming number of my mentions or people who are tweeting at me who are being hateful. I mean, lots of folks, of course, are tweeting supportive things, but among the critical tweets, they're not well thought out arguments. They're not even like nuanced arguments. They're not like, hey, Tim, I think you were wrong about this and here's some reasons why, which, you know, that would be cool. I may or may not respond. I may not have time to, but at least I would appreciate that. It's never that, right? It's always these Nazis. And again, this is not a term I use lightly. I'm talking about folks who are literally Hitler worshippers who send memes around, you know, to Jewish people and anyone they don't like, really, talking about get in the oven, you know, and then they lace it up with some anti-Jewish commentary, etc. And this is what they do with me. And what they do, it's fascinating. It's actually, I've gotten to where I get a kick out of it. They write to me and this is their argument. Go die, Jew. Right? This is the kind of stuff that they say to me. They always point this out like it's the ultimate gotcha, right? Well, you're a Jew. Oh, well, damn, I guess I should delete my Twitter account and not make any arguments anymore, because that's the ultimate, I hate to use this phrase, but ultimate trump card now, I guess, right? Because their assumption when they make that argument, and they do seem to think it's an argument, their assumption is that there is something about Jews as Jews, right, that makes us committed to the destruction of white people. So all these white racists come out of the woodwork when I make anti-racist statements and say there's something about my Jewish blood that is causing me to do that. It's biological or maybe cultural. Something about Jewish blood or psychology that explains why we oppose white racism and white domination. Not because white racism is an abomination or morally wrong. Not because white supremacy has been used against us by people who have racialized us as non-white despite our recent European heritage, but because we want to, in their words, genocide white people. They like to use genocide as a verb. And we apparently as Jews are wanting to genocide them as a way to maintain our power and domination. And they always mention that I'm Jewish like they are revealing some grand secret uncovered by their eagle-eyed researchers at Nazis or Us, right? Like they're CSI detectives and they stumbled upon this and it's like forensic and aha, you're a Jew. And this, of course, ignores for a minute that I have written about and spoken about being Jewish many times. And from the very beginning of my political activism, actually, it's really hard, guys, to out someone who's never been in the closet when it comes to their Jewishness, just so you know. I'm waiting for them to next reveal to the world that I'm a father, and I guess they're going to let the world know this right around the time our daughters are graduating from college. They're a bit slow, but, you know, you got to cut the master race a little slack. Fact is, I've been talking about being Jewish for a long time. I first wrote about it in 1990, actually, when I was just out of college, when I wrote a piece criticizing the state of Israel for its support of apartheid South Africa. And then I spoke about it often during my work against David Duke in Louisiana in 90 and 91 and early 92. Then once I got out on the lecture circuit in 1995, it often came up in one context or another. Beginning in 2001, I wrote several essays over the next 3 years critical of the state of Israel and actually Zionism itself as a philosophy, which I've never supported for reasons that I have discussed repeatedly and may address again in a future commentary. In 2005, with White Like Me, my first book, my memoir, I discuss my Jewishness in the context of my constructed whiteness in this culture, sort of looking at the interactions between what it means to be ancestrally or religiously Jewish, raised Jewish, and yet also be functionally white, whatever one may think of that term in this country. So seriously, outing me as a Jew is not, it's just not an outing. I mean, that's like outing the captain from the 1970s supergroup, The Captain and Tennille, as not actually having ever piloted a boat. Yeah, we know. He's not a real captain. He just has the hat with the anchor on it. We know, like, it's not real, you know? But the fascinating thing really about this argument is this just this notion that they've revealed some important truth. And their argument basically is that Jews are the thing they really are upset about. And you can see this. You go to the Amazon.com review boards of my books and they always jump on. They never read my books. But they get on there and they say, how can you write a book like White Like Me? You're not even white. Aha. But of course, their argument is shitty science anyway, right? And largely irrelevant to the way that I'm using the term white. First of all, the science argument, they're saying Jews are not white people. This is their argument. Their argument is that Jews have been found, according to science, to be genetically distinct from Europeans, from quote unquote white people. That we're a separate race of essentially Asiatics is what they think, right? An Asian subgroup. And they point to this research that has been done, and there has been some research that has found, for instance, there are certain haplotypes, genetic haplotypes, that cluster among Jews that are distinct in terms of the way that they cluster from non-Jews. In other words, what they found is that actually the haplotypes of Jews are more like other Jews who live in other parts of the world than they are people who live right next door to them who aren't Jewish. And so the Nazis take that to mean that there's this thing as the Jewish race. There's this actual scientific distinction. But of course, there are a couple of problems with that argument. Number one, the scientists who have done the research, none of whom, surprise, surprise, are actually white nationalists, because white nationalists and Nazis don't actually do their own research. The folks who did this research on Jewish haplotypes and genetic clustering, not one of them agrees with the conclusion of the white nationalists, the white supremacists, and the neo-Nazis. They are not arguing that Jews are a distinct and separate race of people. They are not calling Jews a subspecies. And if you know anything about biology, you understand we talk about races. Races typically are thought of as subspecies of one species, and there is no genetic difference large enough among humans anywhere on the planet to actually constitute subspeciation. The vast majority of biologists and geneticists would say that there are no, functionally speaking, scientific races in the human race. States, there may be some genetic differences, yes, and the haplotype clustering that the Nazis are referring to here, it would be one of those differences, as would skin color, hair texture, certain facial features controlled by about 6 genes out of the human genome, which has about 30,000 genes. And also, yeah, there are differences. No one's saying there are no biological differences or scientific differences between people called white, people called black, people called Asian, because ancestral lineage and where you have most recently come from as in terms of your ancestry will have certain effects on various things. But what most scientists are very clear about, and certainly the ones that these Nazis are pointing to when it comes to their Jew gene research, is that this is not a subspecies. Jews are not, in fact, a distinct race from quote-unquote Europeans or quote-unquote white people. The second problem with their interpretation of the research is that it was done only on Jewish folks who had 4 Jewish great-grandparents. In other words, Jewish folks for whom there had been, at least in the last couple of generations, no intermarriage outside of other Jews. And the reason that's important, right, is because increasingly, and particularly in the United States, an awful lot of Jewish folks are in fact not marrying other Jews, right? The rates of intermarriage have grown to, I think they're over 50%. I think they're well over 50% now for Jews in the U.S. And this has caused a lot of concern for some folks in the Jewish community who are paranoid about, you know, Judaism's going to die out because of that. And, you know, as someone who is himself married to a non-Jew, my dad was married to a non-Jew, his dad was married to a non-Jew. I'm the third Jewish wise man in my family tree who is not married a Jewish person. Not only do I not have 4 Jewish grandparents, but I only have 1 Jewish grandparent. And that's a story that's very true for a lot of Jews in the United States. And whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing really isn't the point. The point is it's a thing, which means that this research that they're pointing to doesn't apply to an increasing number, probably at least half of the Jews in America and an awful lot of Jews in Europe and around the world, who aren't married to other Jews or whose children don't have 4 Jewish grandparents. And so if it requires endogamy, right, the marriage and reproduction of children with people from your own group in order to constitute a race, the vast majority of Jewish people wouldn't qualify anymore. And by the way, any group that practices endogamy could have certain haplotype clustering and it wouldn't mean anything. My guess is that you could probably see a certain degree of haplotype clusters already for people who were Mormon, even though Mormonism has only been around for, 150 years, 170 years, something like that. Even though Mormonism is a relatively new faith, they practice endogamy, right? They tend to marry other Mormons, they reproduce, they raise their children Mormon. If Mormonism exists for as long as Judaism has existed, I have absolutely no doubt you get a couple thousand years down the line, and I'm fairly confident that you would see haplotype clustering there, but that wouldn't mean that Mormonism had become its own race. If Scientologists, God forbid, are still around in 4,000 or 5,000 years, surely not. Surely Xenu is going to come and take them back before that. But if Scientology is still around in 5,000 years, they also, you know, often marry and raise their kids as Scientologists. They practice a certain degree of endogamy. They probably, too, would have certain haplotype clusters, but that wouldn't mean there was a new Scientology race. This is the result of intramarriage within your own group, not marrying people outside your group. It doesn't actually constitute a splitting off of the human race. So the Nazis don't do very good science, and they still can't explain. And I've always asked them to please explain to me in precise scientific terms, please. And preferably finding someone who actually has a degree in this shit to do it, because having a degree in Stormfront studies doesn't count. A scientific degree, please, that explains how the Jew genes, let's say in my case, the Jew genes on 1/4 of my lineage, and therefore 1/4, let's say, of my ancestral heritage, can cancel out the white genes on the other 3/4, right? If 3/4 of my family ancestry is white, and I mean, they are white, brother. It is Northern Europe. I mean, I'm whiter than most of these Nazis, I guarantee you. Not that I'm trying to brag, because again, I don't even care about being a member of their club. That's what they also seem to think. Like, I'm trying to worm my way into their club. I'm trying to fake my way. I don't give a damn. I'd love to not be connected to these people, frankly. But I am. They act like, I'm trying to be one of the cool kids by calling myself white, even though I know deep down that I'm not. It's like they're Spanky and Alfalfa trying to, you know, police the borders of the He-Man Woman Haters Club to keep Darla out or some shit. I mean, like, you know, I don't really care about your club. I'm just telling you that my ancestry happens to be as, quote, white, end of quote, as theirs. And they can't explain how the Jew genes cancel out the white genes. Again, putting all of those terms in quotation marks. And the reason they can't tell you is there's no science to explain how the Jew genes cancel out the white genes. And by the way, if the Jew genes are strong enough to cancel out the white genes, then white genes are pretty weak ass, which means that whole master race thing goes out the window. So, you know, you got to pick your poison, baby. You either are the master race or you're recessive as hell. And if you're recessive, then maybe y'all don't deserve to rule. Maybe y'all don't deserve to reign supreme. Maybe y'all deserve to lose. So they get the science wrong. But the bigger point, and let me just make this clear, is the way that I'm using the term whiteness when I refer to myself as white or I talk about whiteness is not rooted in science anyway. I'm not trying to make a scientific argument here. I'm not real interested, frankly, in the science piece of it, even though I'm pretty clear what the science piece actually does say, because I can read academic studies quite a bit better than the Nazis can. But the way I'm using whiteness is as a social concept. My argument is that whiteness really isn't a thing biologically anyway, and I know the Nazis disagree, but I'm just talking about the way I'm using it. Whiteness didn't exist, frankly. There was no pan-European unity. We didn't consider ourselves one big happy family for the better part of European history. We were killing one another. I mean, the whole history of Europe is sort of that. You know, it's killing one another and looking for the witch and every now and then writing some good plays. You know, I mean, that's sort of what we did. We wrote plays, conquered stuff, killed people, and looked for witches. And we didn't consider ourselves one big happy family. The English hated the Irish. The Germans hated everyone. Everyone hated them right back. Northern Italians didn't even think Southern Italians were Italians, let alone that they were all part of one big happy white family. Good God. And the Italians, when they came to the U.S., weren't even considered white yet. The Irish, when they came to the U.S., weren't considered white yet. That took a minute. So whiteness is this socially constructed thing. And in the social sense, that's why I call myself white, because I am capable of obtaining the advantages of being perceived in that way, with that term, in that family, in that category. In the United States, when cops see me, employers, bank loan officers, people at the mall when I'm shopping, just average everyday people, teachers in the classroom, they look at me and they see a white person. So the reason I'm white is not because I'm trying to like finagle my way into some genetic family. I don't really give a damn about your genetic family. I'd love to not be genetically linked to any of these bottom feeders who I'm critiquing right now. But what I'm talking about is that in this society, those of us who are Jewish have the ability most of the time, obviously if you're a Jewish person with darker skin or perhaps more quote-unquote stereotypically Jewish presumed and presenting features the way that some people assume Jews look, you might have a harder time. If you're an Orthodox Jew, you know, and visibly therefore different in the way that you dress, etc., you might be targeted for sure. But by and large, to be Jewish in this country is to be viewed as functionally white, irrespective of one's ancestral background, irrespective of one's religious background, cultural background, or even in Nazi terms, genetic background. Because the fact is, even if there were some literal Jew genes that render one different at some genomic level, at the phenotypic level, which is the level we observe in terms of the way that we look and the way that our genotype presents outwardly, there would just be no doubt that most Jews in the United States, at least, would continue to be viewed and are viewed as white. That's how I'm using the term. So much so that, you know, historically, even light-skinned people of color have been able to reap the benefits of white privilege if they were not known as people of color. So whiteness is just not this biological thing or scientific thing. But even if it were, that would not mean that certain folks who are technically not white could not qualify as white in the social sense and reap the benefits therein. So these arguments that these Nazis make are just sort of inherently stupid, but of course, stupid arguments are the hallmark of bigots. I mean, this is why they make this argument, the other argument they make all the time, right? They talk about Jews are running the world, and they always point to the supposedly disproportionate representation of Jews in various institutions as proof, right, that there's some perfidious system of Jewish privilege and domination that's excluding Gentiles, and that there's a system of conspiracy or something behind that. It's interesting how they make that argument. Once again, I mean, these are people, it's not just that they don't know science. They don't know social science either. So they say, for instance, a couple of years ago, there was this piece that this guy wrote to me. He wrote me, I don't know if it was an email or if it was an article he wrote where he was challenging me and I ended up responding to it. You can find the article on my website, timwise.org, if you want to just, you know, go to the search box and hit Jews, it'll come up. Because this guy on this white nationalist website, overt white supremacist website, was making the argument, you know, that there's obviously a horrible system of Jewish privilege. And we know that because Jews have this disproportionate representation in the United States Senate, for instance. You know, there were 13 out of 100 U.S. senators are Jews. And my God, they're only, 2% of the population. Well, actually, depending on how you calculate the numbers, there are different ways of calculating who is and is not Jewish. It ranges from 1.5% to 3%, but fine, we'll just say 2 for the sake of argument. 2% of the population, 13% of the senators, my God! You know, it's overrepresentation by a factor of 6 to 6.5. Yeah, it is that if you're an idiot. It's not that if you understand a basic little social science concept called sampling error. This is some freshman year of college shit, y'all. This is not complicated, unless you're a Nazi. And then it becomes incredibly difficult. So what do I mean when I say sampling error? Well, let's just think about it for a second. There are 100 people in the United States Senate. Each state has 2 reps in the United States Senate, right? 2 senators. If any Jewish person were to run and win in any state, by definition, in that state, they would be 50% of the senators representing that state. My God, well, that's an overrepresentation of 25 to 1. That's a factor of 25. Holy hell. But if you have only 2 people, by definition, if any Jew wins even one of those seats, it would be seen as a massive overrepresentation, because when you have a small group statistically, and you're trying to look at the percentage that they represent in another small group, in this case, Jews, a small group, in another small group, the U.S. Senate, virtually any representation is going to seem disproportionate. And so when you say 13 out of 100 is disproportionate, a couple of things. Number one, the idiot that wrote this piece actually can't even like Google some basic shit about who is and isn't Jewish, because when he wrote that piece, it was actually 11, not 13. I know that seems like a minor detail, but I mean, come on. It's basic research. You're the master race. Get your shit straight. It was 11 out of 100. And you still say, well, that's still 5.5 to 1 over representation or whatever. But once again, like in a small group known as the United States Senate, if any Jews win, it's going to be overrepresentation. By the Nazis' argument, it would be overrepresentation if more than 2 out of 100 U.S. senators were Jewish. Of course, the problem with that argument is you have certain states where the percentage of Jews is much larger than 2%. Some states, there are virtually none, right? And the odds of a Jew representing one of those states is incredibly small, and they don't. But if you look at a state like New York, if you look at a state like California, you look at a state like Florida, you look at states where there are larger numbers of Jews, you really ought not be surprised that you might have one. And especially because if you look at where those Jews typically, both in the House and the Senate, by the way, in the House, it's only 6% representation. So that's not very disproportionate at all. And once again, when you consider certain states have lots of Jews in them, 6% of the House of Representatives is not disproportionate. But I mean, if you think about those states that have large numbers of Jews, they tend to be what? They tend to be Democrats. And the Democratic Party is certainly percentage-wise, more Jewish than the U.S. population as a whole. So once again, you have to adjust for that, right? If the Democratic Party attracts Jewish folks for a number of ideological and philosophical reasons, and it tends to nowadays, and has for quite a while, then the eligible candidates that that party can run are going to be more Jewish than just 2%. So once again, there's this thing called like controlling for other, you know, independent variables. Again, this is some freshman year of college shit. You know, it's not that hard. Even Nazis can do this if they just put their mind to it. I really fundamentally believe in them. I think they can indeed do some basic social science work, but they just don't show any interest in it, right? And so when they make the same argument, they say, well, Jews run the media and they run the financial industry. And then they point to the boards of directors of various media companies and financial institutions to prove this. Several years ago, there was a website, I think it's been taken down since then, but it was a website called Who's a Jew? They're so clever, right? Who's a Jew? And they would argue that when you looked at all these financial institutions, these big banks, Citibank and some others, and you looked at AOL, Time Warner, and you looked at all these, media conglomerates, right? That they, you know, had boards of trustees or boards of directors that were, you know, 12%, 15%, 20% Jewish, my God, right? And they said, see that, I mean, come on, Jews are 2% of the population. If they're 15% of the board here, they're 20% there, that's a massive overrepresentation. Once again, however, there's the problem of sample size. Most of these boards are like 15 people, 20 people. I looked it up at the time. I wrote a piece about that too. Again, it's on my website, timwise.org. You can look it up. The boards they were talking about were like 15 to 20 people, which means what? If you got a board of 15 people and 3 of them are Jews, meaning 12 or not, again, this is like really simple math. Like this is calculator shit. 3 out of 15 are Jews. My God, that's 1 out of 5. Holy hell, that's 20%. That's a overrepresentation by a factor of 10. My goodness. But once again, like, when you have a small sample of 15 people, even three is going to seem like an overrepresentation. Even if you had one, right? If you even had one Jew out of the 15, that would still be a 3-to-1 representation, but it wouldn't mean anything. Not to mention, what kind of idiot actually believes that 3 out of 15 can actually control the institution against the wishes of the other 12, right? You think actually these three Jews out of the 15 people on the board, which represents 20% of the total, such an overrepresentation? What do you think, like, we Jews have some kind of special powder that we, like, spray on the Gentiles and they have to, like, do our bidding or some shit? Like, what do you think? Like, are we spiking your coffee in the morning? What are we doing that allows 3 to control 12? Or there was, like, one of the companies they mentioned, I don't have the piece in front of me, but one of the companies had like 20 people on the board or something, and like 5 of them were Jews. Oh my God, that's 1 out of 4, 25%. Holy hell, that's 12 and a half times the representation of Jews relative to what it ought to be. What the? 5 out of 20. What are the other 15 doing? Like, picking their nose? What are they doing? Are they, like, on their phone? What are they? Are they playing Bejeweled Blitz or Words with Friends or some shit? What are they doing that they're not paying attention? These 5 Jews, like, control everything. What is wrong with these white Gentiles? I mean, if that's for real, if like 5 Jews on your board can control the other 15, you probably need to get all 15 to be Jews, because at least they'd pay attention. I mean, honest to God, right? And then there's another problem. It's not just the sampling error problem, which the Nazis don't understand. There's also this thing called geographic control. Think about the financial industry and the media industry for a second. In addition to the sample size issue I just mentioned about these boards of directors, which are overwhelmingly non-Jewish, by the way, isn't there an also obvious geographic control you need to impose here? Ask yourself the following question. Where are media companies and financial industries headquartered in this country? They're in, by and large, in New York City. And what that means is that if you want to know whether Jews are overrepresented in those industries, you would have to compare the percentage of Jews in those industries at, you know, top levels, not with the national population of Jews, but with the population of Jews in New York, right? Because that's where they're going to live. Like, if you work in the financial industry, you're going to live in New York. If you work in the media, you're probably going to live in New York. You're not going to parachute in from Casper, Wyoming every day for your job at ABC or at CNN. Or on Wall Street. You're not going to live in Omaha and just commute, right? So the real question is, what's the percentage of Jews in New York? And there it is considerably higher, as I think we all know, than 2%. In fact, New York City has the highest concentration of Jews outside, I think, of Israel, of anywhere in the world. And according to which numbers you believe, I've seen numbers that would suggest about 18% of the people in New York City are Jewish. If you look at the greater New York area, it might drop to 10 to 12%, but still, right, considerably higher than the national average. So if you've got an area where, let's say, 15, 18% of the population is Jewish, to have 12%, 10%, 15%, even 20% of the people in certain industries like that being Jewish is not overrepresentation at all. It is exactly what you'd expect. By the same token, if you were to look at the executives in the tobacco industry, which is headquartered where? Not New York. It's headquartered principally in North Carolina. Not a lot of Jews in North Carolina. There are some, but nowhere near the level of, let's say, New York or California. So if you were to look at the tobacco industry, I'm guessing that's pretty much white Gentiles at the top of that. If you look at the auto industry, which historically had been headquartered where? In Michigan and Northern Ohio. Yeah, there are Jews in those places, but nowhere near the level of, let's say, New York or California. So I'm guessing the executives in those places, disproportionately white Gentiles. You look at the insurance industry in Hartford, same thing. The Cattlemen's Association or the cattle industry, probably, I don't know, Nebraska, Colorado, where the hell, Kansas, I don't know where that is. I mean, you look at whatever industry, just pick an industry, and it's going to represent to some extent the geographic location where it is headquartered. Again, this is not hard stuff. I mean, this is like freshman year of college social science, which apparently is just over the heads of Nazis. And, you know, I get it, I know. Thinking is hard. Research is harder. It's a lot easier to just march around with tiki torches chanting or getting tats with badass Viking symbols or sitting around eating Hot Pockets and playing World of Warcraft. But seriously, like, if every time you open your mouth, you prove just how not master racy your group is, And if you've never actually accomplished anything, then you might just want to give it up. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Join us again next week and every Tuesday through the summer for the best of my prior commentaries. And stay tuned for the next chapter of Speak Out with Tim Wise coming later this fall. You can also check out my essays at Medium.com or my website, www.timwise.org, and follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care and stop by again next week.